So, you know, it's really nice to talk to you, as always. We're going to do another episode on Perry Anderson's American Foreign Policy and his thinkers. I think we're actually going to rename the podcast. It's not After the End of History anymore. It's the Francis Peregrine Appreciation Podcast. And I think we've dedicated about 7 or 8 hours on this book already. So hopefully we can wrap it tonight. I think we're at risk of making it the Perry Anderson Podcast. It's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, it'd be nice if we can get him on the show. That's never going to happen, of course.
It could.
Okay, maybe. Maybe one day.
I mean, I doubt we're going to be able to have him, like, you know, do a Zoom call and then synchronize his recording of Audacity and all that kind of stuff. But I could imagine being in the same city as him and taking a tape recorder and asking him a couple questions.
Yeah. I mean, he is a polymath. I think he could figure it out.
It's not hard.
This isn't rocket science, what we're doing, people. But in any case, this is episode number 6 on American foreign policy and its thinkers. Up until this episode, we've been talking about the first part of this book, which is on the American foreign policy section called Imperium, and now we're moving into its thinkers, which is called Consilium. Mario is going to take us through the thinkers that are mentioned in this book. Not all very likable, but make up an important part of the intelligentsia and the way that grand strategy shaped and given a common kind of sense and purpose. And I think there's a lot here. We've been talking about Gramsci, but I think there's a lot in explaining this using Gramsci in understanding how the intellectual class, this particular intellectual grouping, this amphibious grouping between academia and the State Department, really gives mission and strategy to American foreign policy thought and real decisions on the ground, more for worse than for better, as we'll learn. But this section of the book is broken up primarily into two parts. One is on crusaders, and what he means by that is liberals and Wilsonians, those who are in the Wilsonian train of mind, who are for multilateral decision-making, the acting in accordance of international law and agreements and accords. And then the part after that is on realist ideals.
Yeah.
And a group of thinkers like Robert Art, and Robert Kagan, who in some ways could be described as realists, but I think Anderson is critical of the sense in which they are understood as realists, and he has a deeper appreciation for Robert Art than he does Robert Kagan. But instead of just name-dropping all of this, I think we should get right into what each one of these thinkers believes and why they're categorized under the Crusader section as Wilsonians or under the realist ideal section as essentially neoconservatives or realists in a Kissingerian sense. I mentioned before this amphibious nature of these creatures, you know, and Anderson used that term before we started talking about the swamp or anything like that, and, you know, 2016 to 2020. But he means by that thinkers that go between academia and the State Department, and they are at a certain remove from the day-to-day administration of the imperialist war machine, and they do have, because of that remove, some ability to put forward some fanciful ideas of the direction of American grand strategy. And I think, Mario, what you'll take us through in the following sections is how some of their ideas are inconsistent if you look at the beginning of their thought to the end of the thought, and how their ideas have mixed a sense of domestic chaos with a rejuvenation, a need for rejuvenation of the American exceptionalist project. And I think their thought evolves over the course of the pre-1989 end of history, as it were, and what happens after that period. So without much more introduction, I thought maybe that can give you some of the context of where we're coming from in contextualizing some of these thinkers and preparing our listeners for what we mean by these flights forward in their conception of what American foreign policy should be.
Yeah, I think that perfectly captures the way that Perry Anderson thinks about this, I guess, intellectual milieu of policy planners and intellectuals and writers. Many of them have been, you know, are extrapolating from their experiences working for the national security state. And the flight forward you talked about, which is this sort of tendency amongst many of them towards a kind of imaginative and often overly optimistic idea of what American power can do in the world is one of the things that Perry Anderson is going to criticize them for throughout in particular ways. The I wanted to first, though, say a few things about what we should get out of this part of the book. I mean, just to back up a, you know, a second, I guess, both for our listeners, but also for you know, ourselves as we try to think about how we're discussing books that in some way put us in touch with a tradition of writing and thinking about problems in international relations, so that when we're writing things, we're aware not just of the intellectual field, the ideological poles within it, but also how to write in a sort of polemical fashion against some of the presuppositions and assumptions that are part of so much mainstream foreign policy thinking.
Yeah, and I want to add something there. And when Mario's talking about polemics, we're not going to be talking about leftist foreign policy thinkers by any means. They're not part of the common movement of radical thought on the left by any means. But what Anderson is doing, and I think it's important to understand who Anderson is when he talks about realism, he wants to talk about foreign policy and the intelligentsia in the United States to provide an understanding of what leftists, what the workers' movement might be up against. He wants there to be an understanding without euphemism of what liberalism represents or what any of their retrenchment ideas might represent, like Charles Kupchan. But Charles Kupchan, who he criticizes as wanting to modernize empire and does have this view of retrenchment, pulling back troops from various areas, and he wants his readers to understand this is not in the service of progress, you know, and human welfare and security for a broader part of the population. In fact, it's just a drawing back to better leap forward in pushing forward American imperialist strategy. So when Mario is talking about polemics here, he's talking about understanding in a realistic way, a realist way, what we're up against in American state planners' ideas and how they shape the world.
Yeah, and you know, further to that point, it's worth noting that this selection of writers that Perry Anderson chose to discuss in this last part of his book are not necessarily people that he has a tremendous amount of respect for. Some he does respect, but he thinks of them as basically representative examples that give a good indication of at least people who are productive writers, who are part of this sort of common flock of foreign policy thinkers and advisors. Now, it should just, you know, I guess be noted that there some of the people who aren't discussed is an indication of this. He doesn't really discuss John Mearsheimer, except I think in a footnote, or our friend
Christopher Lane,
who we know that he appreciates a great deal, because these are people who are not really advisors to the prince, because they're not. You could say their foreign policy thinking is not really heated and in the Beltway, and for that reason they don't comprise much of the discussion of the part of the book called Concilium. I think that another aspect of this selection is the way that he sees even the people who he respects are unable to really imagine any kind of, in any substantive way, a retrenchment of American power.
Right.
And that is obviously one of the more common similarities or one of the commonalities between of various stripes of foreign policy thinkers who are popular, who most often will be seen in the pages of magazines like Foreign Affairs, or who usually get to preferment in actual government posts, right? None of them can really take seriously or really heed a retrenchment of American power. And that's really one of the common denominators and one of the bases of criticism he has with a lot of them.
Right. And although they may have some limited sense of retrenchment in their program, a limited number of troops being pulled back, say, you know, some ambiguity on NATO or opposition to NATO, it really is in the service of a broader project of repairing U.S. empire. All agree in some sense or another, fundamentally, that the world is and has to be in the U.S.'s image. Otherwise, anarchy will reign supreme and chaos is the order of the day.
Or some, not all of them have to, I think,
many of them do think what you just said, that it has to be shaped in America's image. But a few of them, especially Kupchin and I guess and Robert Art, of course, don't necessarily think that it has to be constructed in America's image, but that America has to play a leading role.
Yeah, well, I have some questions about that, and I think we should have a discussion when we get to that point. But for now, I think we've given pretty good context on why we're thinking about this grouping of intellectuals, generally what they have to say. But let's go into the details now, and I've kind of primed the discussion by mentioning that there are two sections, one on Crusaders and the other on realist ideals. So why don't you take us through and give us a brief view of what each one of the Crusaders, as it were, thinks, and why is he calling this Crusaders? What does that title mean in this chapter?
It's called Crusaders because it basically connotes figures who argue that America has a moral mission in the world and that it mm-hmm. should construct its foreign policy around, if not necessarily in a kind of totally imperialistic way, making the world in America's image, at least that America has a special responsibility and role in shaping international order and institutions that are, you know, I guess you would say continuous with American conceptions of liberty and political order. And
that's right.
So that means, and the figures he discusses in this section are Walter Russell Mead and John Eikenberry, Michael Mandelbaum, and Charles Kupchin.
That's
Charles
right.
Charles Kupchin. Yeah. And obviously the first figure is somewhat, I guess, on the fringes of neoconservatism because he had, you know, after the Iraq War, went with Francis Fukuyama to work on American interest mm-hmm. and writes a lot about American traditions in foreign policy thinking. And I think more than anybody else has written about the Jacksonian element in American foreign policy that has, you could say, recurred and pops its head up every now and then. And it is an aspect that we'll discuss in just a little bit that he thinks that the foreign policy establishment should be more aware of as an element within, you could say, the kind of layers of the American psyche that he argues, you know, Trump is in some sense a representative of, that should be harnessed better by American foreign policy planners.
And so just to pause there quickly, I mean, you mentioned one part of the ingredients for Mead that make up foreign policy thought he has, this taxonomy of four individual points of view. Jacksonianism is one. Then he talks about Hamilton. He talks about Jefferson. And then finally, Wilson. So you mentioned Jackson, and you said that he's paying a bit more attention to that element of American foreign policy thought. And the way I interpreted this is that Jacksonianism is really this rugged protection of national security at all costs, which sounds like about as hardcore of a realpolitik perspective as perhaps you're going to get among those four. Is that an accurate conception? And then if you could also speak to what the other three elements are.
Yeah. So the Jacksonian element, yeah, definitely is the one that's most, you know, amenable to realist thinking, but only in the sense of it being without shame in defending American national interest without all of the moral window dressing of liberal internationalism. But mm-hmm. it's not realist in the terms of necessarily always seeing, you know, the international system as an anarchic one, which should force people to realize other states have legitimate national interests or something like that. It's instead a sort of form of, you know, he argues a kind of, Perry Anderson puts it this way, a kind of truculence mm-hmm. in the face of any nation that's perceived as an adversary. Now, there are other positive things that Mead sees in the Jacksonian tradition, and that is usually limitations in the goals for war because of the fact that Jacksonians tend not necessarily to want to have a long-term engagement in, say, spreading democracy to another country. The tenor of Jacksonian or the kind of contribution of the Jacksonian element in foreign policy thinking or also in popular mobilization for war usually wants full-scale war, but for a limited period of time until there's a decisive victory. And then troops can be withdrawn. It's sort of the way he talks about it. Now, another aspect of this Jacksonian, you could say, element is rugged individualism and a kind of folk egalitarianism that is part of the Jacksonian tradition, part of, you could say, a kind of, you know, white working class American kind of culture.
That the frontiersman, and I think is the way it gets, the cartoon for it is the frontiersman.
Exactly. And, obviously, we don't have to have a whole discussion about the Jacksonian, culture of America and stuff like that, but that's basically what it is for him. And regarding the other strands in American foreign policy thinking, the Hamiltonian, Jeffersonian, and Wilsonian are the following. A Hamiltonian thinking is, characterized by the American tendency to want to organize markets, spread free trade, and organize the national state towards an economic policy that benefits manufacture and banking. The Jeffersonian is best captured in Jefferson's own line, an empire of liberty, which meant a kind of moral purpose to the American experiment, right, in representative democracy, with a wariness of external entanglements and a general suspicion about the fallen world of the continental powers.
Right.
It was about limiting that entanglement in great power politics, whereas the Wilsonian strand is more prone towards the moralizing crusades and human rights and securing liberty and freedom throughout the world, which demands and justifies a greater military presence of America in the world. So that's the basic breakdown of these strands. And, one of the things he, through different books that we'll discuss, from, Mortal Splendor to the one that is probably, I guess, the most interesting to Perry Anderson, a book called Special Providence, written in 2001, just before the September 11th attacks. Power, Terror, Peace, and War, written in 2004. And then God in Gold, Britain, America, and the Making of the Modern World, written in 2007. One of the things I think that's interesting about all of these books is, and this is very characteristic of so much of the foreign policy writing for American audiences, is this attempt to, especially amongst writers who are, writing to give advice to the prince, who are either seeking preferment themselves or seeking to shape the debate, they often will try to recast American traditions or the American national character, so that going forward, for a book that sees itself as responding to some epochal challenge or some new form of foreign policy dilemmas, seeks to cast the present moment in relationship to longer traditions in America's national character. And this sort of way of writing about foreign policy in conversation with aspects of national identity is a common thing amongst all these writers. And in the case of Walter Russell Mead, he's doing this successively throughout these different books in a way that is a sort of way of justifying and explaining the real social, religious, and demographic bases of American exceptionalism, and why it's still, it's not merely a kind of way of thinking or a type of after-the-fact justification that American imperialism makes whenever it wants to do whatever it wants, whenever it does what it wants to do. It's rather a deep, both political and ideological imperative in American political discourse, but it also has, there's a real social basis behind it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the span of his historical account and justification for specific policies in contemporary matters is probably broader. That span is much broader than the other thinkers that we get in this section. And it's very similar in ways to what we saw on the Bevins, for example, in giving this the settler colony and what that means for America's behavior in the world. Of course, Bevins draws very different conclusions than Mead. Mead lands on this kind of manifest destiny, Anglo-American pride, and it lands on this what you call mystico commercial kind of vision. But when you're, as you were talking through this, it reminded me of a quote that I wanted to bring up from Gramsci, since I mentioned him at the beginning, and I just want to give this a bit of context. And I think Gramsci was really sharp on these questions of the role of the intelligentsia and the intellectual class, if we can call it that, in giving vision and a common purpose to the class that it supports. And this is from The Formation of the Intellectuals, which he wrote in prison. Every social group coming into existence on the original terrain of an essential function in the world of economic production creates together with itself, organically, one or more strata of intellectuals which give it homogeneity and an awareness of its own function, not only in the economic, but also in the social and political fields. And I think that perfectly captures the intellectual role, the intellectual purpose that somebody like Walter Mead has. And unlike some of these other thinkers that are very specific on questions of, say, NATO or the relationship with China and Russia, Mead is giving you this breadth of purpose and justifying, as you said, decisions made today in the context of this great spiritually enlightened Anglo-American tradition.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting to note, and this is something Perry Anderson says in the book in his discussion of Robert Kagan, who we'll get to later. These both Walter Russell Mead and Kagan are taking so many of the same fundamental historical tendencies and factors that were part of the William Appleman Williams and Walter Lefebvre understanding of what is the continuity of American sort of imperialist thinking. For the revisionist historians, of revisionist diplomatic historians, it was about how the expansion of America into a continental state could easily be transformed into a ideology of imperialist extra-regional hegemony, right? And both Walter Russell Mead and Kagan would basically say, yeah, and that's what makes America both distinctive and makes it a necessity for America to lead the world. And obviously, these are not chauvinist people. I mean, I've watched a lot of interviews with them. They might stand for policies you and I consider imperialist or wrong or whatever, but they don't celebrate the historical crimes of America, but they see them as part of the story and part of the you could say the shaping of the national character of the United States.
So one thing that Anderson says about Mead and I think this might help us get into some of his other books. Anderson writes, Mead was a virtual pallbearer of empire and mortal splendor. By the time of Special Providence, he had become its trumpeter, though the term itself now disappeared. So what does he mean by that? It seems like, I was mentioning before that you would take us through some of the changes in these thinkers' ideas. What does he mean that Mead evolved from a pallbearer of empire to one who became its trumpeter, or one who obviously supported it wholeheartedly?
Yeah, and American Splendor was written sort of during the height of the Iran-Contra debacle. And so the luster of empire was sort of, waning. And Mead argued that this was an indication of a sort of loss of appeal of the United States throughout the Third World, such an important area for its, continued dominance through the up to the end of the Cold War, right? I mean, obviously, some of the things we've talked about before is how, the real bloody arenas of the Cold War were throughout the Third World and in Asia, mm-hmm. Africa, and Latin America. So he basically, in this era of the Iran-Contra crisis, thought that the mixture of lack of moral authority, a country in need of political and institutional reform, held back by its archaic constitution, sort of the Reaganomics, declining of living standards, the growing, yawning budget deficits that were part of that era, called for a total revamp of the organization and orientation of the U.S. state. And so he, in this early book in 87, thought that there needed to be a reinvention of the New Deal that would harness a kind of more populist and radical drive that would spread prosperity from through, you know, America and the Third World and be the basis for a renewed round or renewed generation of America's hegemonic power. And this is what he means. This is what Perry Anderson means by him being once a virtual pallbearer of the empire, seeing that it had all these flaws to later on in 2001 in the book Special Providence, being its trumpeter, basically changing his tune and seeing that the particular form of American, I guess, finance-led capitalism being now seen as the basis of American power and in itself a sustainable project. And so along the lines of what we were saying before about Mead's, you know, one of the consistent themes throughout his book is tracing the four threads of, you know, Hamiltonian, Jeffersonian, Jacksonian, and Wilsonian foreign policy thinking throughout American history. And whereas in that book in 87, Mortal Splendor, he saw a kind of domination of a Hamiltonian elitist variant of American foreign policy being dominant that was, you know, part of a tradition of Anglo-American commercial expansion and, you know, basically what we think of as the halcyon days of neoliberalism. He thought that in that period, America was becoming unmoored from the other tradition, which is the Jeffersonian and Jacksonian emphasis on, you know, strengthening a democratic tradition, domestic prosperity. He thought that you know, in 87, that the U.S. was sort of abandoning that other commitment, which would have, which is really, he argues, such an important basis of American national strength, right? Mm-hmm. And so too in the book Special Providence in 2001, he follows the same theme of tracing the four strands and looking at and saw a great basis in that book for optimism about the way that these threads were coalescing into a kind of coherent American direction. He basically thought that many of the things that had been the cause of social instability in the previous book were now sources of stability. Now they became a kind of basis for an optimism about the complex interplay between the four strands, and that also, most importantly, that the renewal of a kind of Jeffersonian tradition, Jeffersonian and Wilsonian traditions of moral obligation to spread democratic and social ideals around the world was sort of at its peak right before September 11th.
I was laughing a little bit because the way you describe it, it sounds... It sounds kind of ridiculous to me. It's like he's describing the four humors of the human body or something. It's like, you know, phlegm, blood and bile. And, you know, we got into this point where, you know, in 2001, at the height of this unipolar moment, it seemed like the United States could just easily, you know, combine and, you know, moderate these humors of the body and do a perfectly great progressive job in the world. And Anderson pushes back against that. And he says, actually, you know, the real tradition in American foreign policy thought has been more like Wilsonianism and TR, and he means Teddy Rooseveltianism, which I think is more in line with the Jacksonian paradigm. So he shifts gears a little bit from Mead after that point, after, you know, levying that criticism, and he starts to talk about this figure, Michael Mandelbaum, who I think is kind of a Wilsonian in a much more dedicated way. Right. Let's begin with Mandelbaum. Where does he fit in the Wilsonian tradition?
Michael Mandelbaum is a writer and professor, I think, at Johns Hopkins. He's only been an academic, I believe, and he's Wilsonian because he thinks that basically one of the big lessons of the Cold War and, you know, writing in the aftermath of America's victory in the Cold War, that the U.S. really does stand for the Wilsonian ideals and was, throughout that period, a promoter of democracy, peace, and free markets. And nothing proved that more than the fact that not only did most states sort of in some symbolic way stand in solidarity with the U.S. after the September 11th attacks, but also that all states, including communist China, saw entry into the global capitalist system as a sine qua non of membership into the entry in, as a modern state. That fact represented the, you could say, the victory of the spread of America's ideals and interests throughout the international system. He thought that, you could say, now looking back in hindsight, something that was probably way too optimistic, thought that it would, the next task for the United States was to oversee the entry of Russia and China into the liberal world order. Objective of the West to transform and incorporate them, he sort of construed as a, being a similar process to the way the U.S. incorporated formerly fascist Japan and Germany into the world system that the U.S. Constructed after World War II. Now, there are obvious reasons to think that that's not a viable goal, and I think most people and most liberal internationalists don't really see the possibility of bringing China into the fold in the same way they may have in the 1990s and even early 2000s. But there's other books that Perry Anderson references by Mandelbaum are The Frugal Superpower, written in 2010, and That Used to Be Us, written in 2011, which are more sort of, you could say, pessimistic or rueful accounts of the decline of America's financial and budgetary viability, the questioning whether or not the United States either has political will or the it's economically viable for it to sustain its expansive engagement around the world. And this is a constant, this is a theme that Anderson recognizes in all these writers, is that many of them are able to recognize problems in the American economy or in its domestic system, but none of them really have proper solutions to it. And never do these, does recognition of these problems allow them to conceive of a retrenchment of American power. But Mandelbaum and The Frugal Superpower, you know, warns of the problems of inequality, welfare entitlements, Keynesian deficits combined with tax cuts. And then he co-authored another book with Thomas Friedman, that prolific dullard Thomas Friedman, called That Used to Be Us, which also references all these, you know, decline, all these other indices of decline in American prosperity, decline in education, decline in infrastructure spending, decline in R&D, and, you know, they have imaginative solutions to this, one of them being a radical centrist third party. One of the other things that Perry Anderson criticizes Mandelbaum for is his slow learning curve on the Iraq war, that the fact that in the beginning he saw that the mission in Iraq was to bring that Wilsonian triad of peace, democracy, and markets as part of a larger project in the whole Middle East. Then after a couple of years, it became just a mission to bring peace by depriving Baghdad of weapons of mass destruction, not so much about democracy. Then by the time of the book, A Frugal Superpower in 2010, Mandelbaum saw it for, you know, what you and I saw it for when we were just dumb 18-year-olds, and that was a totally bungled operation and a invasion of a country on totally false pretenses. To Mandelbaum's credit, he was critical of Clinton's expansion of NATO in the 90s, seeing it as a kind of a non-solution to a problem that didn't really exist. And for that reason, it's a blunder. By poking the Russian bear when there really wasn't so much of a strategic risk of an expansive Russia such that they needed to be checked. Instead, it was simply insulted, and that sort of poisoned relations between the U.S. and Russia.
This is where I really see the difference. One of the crucial differences between Mandelbaum and Eikenberry is that the latter, Eikenberry, is going to, he doesn't have these criticisms. He's not going to, you know, he's not going to put himself out there to say the expansion of NATO was a mistake. He's a true believer. He's for the expansion in NATO. So I don't want to say that's the specific difference between Eikenberry and Mandelbaum, but what do you think is the main differentiator between the two. Could you tell us a little bit about Eikenberry and where he's different in outlook from Mandelbaum? I mean, he too is a diehard Wilsonian in many ways, right? But is it a different temper? What is the, is it?
Well, one difference is the fact that Mandelbaum actually criticized the expansion of NATO, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s. But they are both, you know, Wilsonians. I think Perry Anderson thinks of Eikenberry as a more almost religious devotee of Wilsonianism. He calls him the poet laureate of liberal internationalism, waxing poetical or rhapsodic about the transformative power of Wilsonian ideals, and maybe being guilty of this thing we described earlier as this flight forward on the part of many of these foreign policy thinkers. He's a strong defender of the principle of the responsibility to protect, which is what's used to justify all kinds of interventions by the U.S. He argues some strange things about the U.N. and Security Council, that the Security Council should be cleansed of the power of any member to veto actions of collective security.
Right, which would shift the balance towards democratic nations.
Yeah, it also means that the interests of states like China and Russia, wouldn't be very well represented in issues of justifying the use of multilateral force, basically, right? Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. It would change the balance towards democracies. He has this conception that there should be a concert of democracies formed to grant legitimacy to interventions thwarted by the UN Security Council vote of Russia or China. And he has two important books. One is Forging a World Under Law, U.S. National Security in the 21st Century, which is basically argues along the lines we've just described of how the U.S. should transform the United Nations, use multilateral institutions to push for the spread of liberty and rule of law. And the other book, written in 2011, is Liberal Leviathan, which is a kind of, also Panglossian or roseate justification for liberalism as essentially the softest form of empire. He says it, in a sense, it's not possible for liberalism to be imperial because it reconciles power and hierarchy with cooperation and legitimacy, which is to say that it brings into consensus so many other states through the use of multilateral institutions that states are dominating others in the normal way we think of international relations.
I don't know if Charles Kupchan is discussed in the same context. I don't remember. But what was notable to me in both the discussion on Eikenberry and Mandelbaum is that Anderson is doing sort of like a field test, not a field test really, but he has a rubric on evaluating these thinkers according to their ideas on NATO, for one, Iraq, the war in Iraq in 2003, starting in 2003, and the third major point, Russia and China.
Yeah. No, exactly. That's a really good way of thinking about how to categorize all of these figures that we're talking about in Consilium. So in regards to NATO, you have Mandelbaum being critical of NATO expansion. Eikenberry is for it, right? Because it's a multilateral institution that the U.S. dominates and is the basis for consent amongst democracies.
So simple, really.
Yeah. And then on Russia and China, Eikenberry, I think is, for the attempt to integrate both of those countries into the liberal ecumene. He thinks that the rise of China could be handled with a kind of regional strategy in East Asia that basically wrangles all of America's allies through multilateral institutions and multilateral approaches to slowing China's rise. And, a person like Eikenberry was very critical of the Bush doctrine and the Bush administration's kind of conservative nationalism. The reason why he would oppose the Iraq war would be because it didn't have multilateral support and the seal of approval of the UN, right? But he's fine with humanitarian interventions if they have UN approval or if they have a multilateral basis of support.
All right, so how do we get into Kupchan?
I guess one way of comparing Kupchan and Eikenberry would be the suggestion of a consort or directorate of major states. In the case of Eikenberry, it was the idea of forming a consort of democracies that would pool a sort of multilateral basis of support for types of liberal internationalist policies and humanitarian interventions, whereas Kupchan is not, you could say, has a more of a tinge of realism in that he doesn't think that any such concert or what he calls a global directorate of great powers needs to be comprised only of democracies, but rather responsible stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And that's really the most important thing for global order. He is also, like Eikenberry, responding to the loss of legitimacy of the U.S. after the unilateral intervention in Iraq. He recognized that there was a, you could say, similar to Meade, recognized there's this possibility of the type of bipartisan consensus for American military power combined with multilateral partnerships that was part of the Cold War coming unglued. As indeed it sort of in many ways has in the context of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that on, you know, in this new terrain, a new kind of grand strategy had to be forged, one that realized that the world was becoming a multipolar place and that this idea of a global directorate was a better way of anchoring global order. That would mean nations like Russia, China, and Japan would be involved in a kind of conscious effort to not only help settle issues of promoting, you know, peace, but also a kind of way of insulating their foreign policy from the domestic roots of partisan politics, an issue much more likely in America or Japan. And this is all, you know, an attempt to keep the larger project of liberal internationalism alive.
Are you going to try to speak a little bit of French for us here now?
Reculer pour mieux sauter.
There you go. And that's exactly what we were talking about at the beginning, which is this drawing back in order to better prosecute its mission as a, you know, a protectorate of the liberal capitalist world.
Well, he basically thinks that the U.S. should drop its sort of scruples and insistence on types of regime and work with states as long as they're en route to a form of politically legitimate capitalist modernity, which, of course, includes China and Russia. And he doesn't think it means that the U.S. should forsake its what they describe as their United American values, including the right to intervene for humanitarian reasons or the responsibility to protect, but that there should be a, you know, regularized form of partnership and power sharing between states like China and Russia. And he also, part of that is, I guess, informed by a realization of the longer term fruits or outcomes of globalization. In this book, No One's World, written in 2012, he's sort of more pessimistic about the direction of America, that other nations are starting to fill the gap between, the first world and third world, that even if there's more inequality in the world, more nations have become modern, stable countries and have populations that have attained a, you know, income level and level of education comparable to, you know, American middle class. China, of course, in particular, is set to overtake the U.S. in various measures. It's under these circumstances that the U.S. can't count on doing what Eikenberry's strategy would imply, which is, you know, corralling others into the institutional order that the U.S. has created. Instead, realize that rising powers like China will seek to, they'll be sort of revisionist powers, which is, it means that they will use their membership within the institutional parameters that they've been brought into to, in accordance with their own interests and values, just as the U.S. has, constructed this institutional order along the lines of its own values and interests. The U.S. will have to, and the West in general is going to have to partner with them and work with them in those institutions, and not, and excluding them on the basis of their lack of liberal democracy is not a viable option.
It seems like a softening of Wilsonianism in some ways then.
I think so, yeah. I think that's fair to say. Basically, dropping of democracy promotion with the major powers. Kupchin says the U.S. has to become sort of adopt a multicultural respect for varieties of governments and values abroad.
Yeah, likely to happen, sure.
Well, the U.S. might be forced to in some cases, that there's no need to insist on liberal democracy being the standard of acceptance as a stakeholder in the global system. Instead, responsible governance and local legitimacy and stability were all that mattered. He thinks that Europe should spend more on its defense. He's pro-NATO, but if he just thinks that there should be more burden sharing. Here's a quote from Kupchin that captures his own, I guess, his own criticism of American both optimism and hubris. This is Kupchin in No One's World. The United States still aspires to a level of global dominance for which it has insufficient resources and political will. American elites continue to embrace a national narrative consistent with this policy. Indispensable nation, the American century, America's moment. These and other catchphrases like them still infuse political debate about U.S. strategy. They crowd out considered debate about the more diverse global order that lies ahead. So it's basically a kind of liberal internationalist realization of the imperatives of multipolarity, the fact that the vision of how to bring China into the fold is not going exactly as planned, yet they're still a responsible power and stakeholders that the U.S. should be willing to work with.
I want to end this section by quoting what is one of my favorite lines of the book, and it's a summary of Kupchin. All this sounds really great, all this retrenchment talk, limited NATO intervention, bringing Russia and China into the fold without the requirement of becoming democracies. But Anderson notes, empires, like individuals, have their moments of false modesty. The kind of retrenchment envisaged by Kupchin belongs to them. Between the lines, its motto is an old one. Go ahead, Mario.
Reculez pour mieux sauter.
There you go.